This podcast of The Treatment is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers.
From KCRW in Santa Monica, this is The Treatment.
Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's a treat to me to have the authors of The Wedding Crashers here, and I'll ask them to introduce themselves on each of their mics so we know who's whom.
I'm Steve Faber.
I'm Bob Fisher.
Thanks for doing the show, guys. One of the things if I'm going to ask you to do a little bit is to describe the movie a little bit for the nine people who haven't seen it yet, given it was one of the biggest comedy hits of last year.
Well, The Wedding Crashers is a story that takes place during the Second World War, during the invasion of Poland. And no, it's not. It's a film about two guys who are a little too old to be crashing weddings, yet still do. They create fake identities for themselves, crash weddings in order to meet girls. And I think you know what we mean by meet girls.
And crash weddings, for that matter.
They are sort of hoisted by their own petards. They crash a wedding, a very big wedding, a very prominent politician, Kennedy-esque politician, and there are many petards at the wedding, and they're hoisted. They sort of get stuck.
Well, Bob, turn this to somebody a little bit less serious for a second. But one of the things that sort of struck me, and we talked before we got started, but very important to me, is that it's a movie that feels like a 70s comedy in that it's very much about – as much about politics, both sort of – actual politics and sexual politics as it is just being sort of a bad taste comedy. And that must have been crucial for you guys in terms of doing it.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, all those 70s comedies had a huge impact on us, you know, partially because that's when we grew up and started watching movies. But as well as this, you know, the sort of like movies on the cusp of the 70s and the 80s when, you know, Harold Ramis started making movies with Animal House and whatnot. And as you were saying earlier, there is sort of a political content to Animal House as well, and a sort of a class component in that movie that we wanted to bring to this one as well. Also, we're fans of those 30s class comedies, and we feel as though there hasn't been a lot of that going on in film lately, and we wanted to, however possible in sort of a, you know, mainstream way, bring that into this movie.
Well, see, because one of the things I thought was kind of interesting too is it's a movie that doesn't necessarily say, which is unfortunately the big message of 80s movies that we've been dealing with ever since, that it's great to be rich. The movie doesn't necessarily say that.
No, it says the opposite, frankly. It says, well, we're sort of obsessed because neither of us are. I think we're both grandchildren of immigrants. And so, you know, neither of us came from a lot of money. And I think these sorts of old American moneyed families have a built-in kind of decrepit nature. They sort of have the seeds of their own destruction. And we think that's funny. We're sick, but we think it's funny and disturbing.
Yeah, as well as there's this sort of tendency in movies to act as though that's no longer an issue, as though class doesn't play a factor in the way in which people interact. And so we wanted to try to do a film where that played into it. You know?
It's funny, too, because just seeing all the different kinds of weddings, too, even offers a little bit of a kind of cultural perspective on these guys. But also in this weird way, they kind of like – almost American colonialists. They're invading every possible land they can.
Because they think they can. They have the hubris to think they can. I mean, that's why it was so fun to have them hoisted. We're back to the petards, but that's why it was so fun, because these guys really think they can walk to a door and through their sheer hubris tell people an Indian wedding, for example, and tell people their names are Chuck Vindaloo and so on and get right in. And it's sort of that American, you know, go-to spirit.
Yeah, and I think that, like, not to torture the metaphor too far, but I think that they're very much under the impression that they're bringing a good time. And to some extent they are. There's, of course, probably debris that fall out the next day, but
we're talking to the authors of The Wedding Crashers, which is now on DVD, by the way. To me, I'm reminded a little bit of almost the old Hope Crosby comedies, these sort of guys who kind of wander in and just through sheer arrogance make themselves the center of the party in that way that, you know, certainly Caddyshack and Animal House sort of took guys who were like that and did that with them too.
We love those guys. We love guys like that. To us, because to me, I think to both of us, we walk around angry, alienated. You know, we don't know why.
But you're writers. You have to be.
We have to be depressed. And maybe that's just me. And we see a lot of people like that. They don't know what they're doing with their lives. And we like to write about people that opt out, you know, opt out of society and make a choice to sort of take a different track. And these guys are definitely taking a different track. I mean, they're not going through the sort of standard dating relationship rituals.
Yeah.
They're disturbed. You know, they've actually turned it on its head.
In a strange way, they've sort of, you know, it's their job to mediate divorces. And so they see the fallout of love. And these guys are sort of sitting on the outside of society, choosing not to participate, not making any kind of commitments. So in the way, you know, they're very much existing on the margins. And they make these sort of periodic raids on the ordinary and, you know, at these weddings or whatever. And so the movie, in a sense, is about these guys finding some way to make commitments that don't violate you know, their sort of principles of what, you know, what they see wrong with what society has to offer them.
But it seems to me partially in seeing the movie, you guys are writing a movie to respond to something that hasn't been in movies for a long time, which is to bring comedy with a point of view. And a movie about guys who think of themselves as being exploiters who have to have the tables turned on them because they're so shallow and self-absorbed. But that even that's been missing because movies tend to celebrate those guys more than you do it in the script.
Well, you know, even look at the Christopher Walken character, the Secretary of Treasury. I mean, he's a crasher too. You know, he sits at a table and discusses his own flesh and blood, his son who's in the film who's gay and sees him as a political asset. And not a son. I mean, he's crashing in on the idea of what family is supposed to be as well, and not in a good way, you know. So yeah, I think that, you know, certainly I think after 9/11, right after 9/11, this film would not have gotten made. It was very difficult to get an R-rated comedy made, and especially an R-rated comedy that sort of attacked institutions. But you know, now we did it, and I think it'll be a little easier.
Let me ask you this, Steve. Do you think that part of it for you is just you felt like comedy really needed a sort of breath of fresh air that hadn't been in it? I mean, because
– Yes.
Because even a lot of the comedies that sort of follow the tenets of what you guys were doing, at least doing certain things, trying to deal with, you know, exploiters and guys who are smarter than everybody else, is that these are – you basically admit that these guys are infantile in the movie.
Yeah.
And we sort of know that.
I think comedy needed to be defibrillated. I think there was comedy was absolutely numb, I feel like.
Was comedy numb or were you numb to comedy is what it was?
I was numb to comedy. Comedy was numb to me, and I wanted to defibrillate comedy. And yes, these guys are infantile. That's true. But in a way, they're sort of anarchists, and they don't have any respect for the institution of marriage at all. None whatsoever. And even the end of the film, I mean, their idea of success in relationships is really twisted. I mean, Vince, you know, sort of agrees at one point in the third act to taking the relationship to the next level, and he thinks that means a threesome. So I think comedy has been sort of – but, you know, I think romantic comedy in particular has been particularly bland as of late. At least in the last 10 years, you see in the first 7 minutes a guy and you see a girl come onto the screen. And now you wait 94, 95 tortured minutes to find out how exactly that guy is going to end up with that girl. A few years ago, I lost my ability to sit through that. I wanted to vomit because the second I saw her, I knew there was going to be some sort of ridiculous rejection followed by some ridiculous proposal at the end. And it didn't seem very particularly clever, you know, of late. So I think – and, you know, box office is down. It's been consistently down. I think people are feeling a need to turn this stuff on its head a bit.
Part of the thing that's sort of interesting as well is that, again, thinking about those 30s movies, that the female characters were so strong and so interesting, and so often they were, in a way, the con men, you know. Certainly the Barbara Stanwyck character. And as well those Capra movies as well, you know. And so there is, and particularly lately in romantic comedies, so very few really interesting or complicated female characters and or who had any kind of attitude about their sexuality. So one of the things that was fun about writing the Isla Fisher character in this movie was to have a woman have, you know, a complete and sort of intentional sexuality about her that was really fun to do. And we tried to do that also in the opening sequence, that these guys weren't just predators, that it seemed as though it was sort of a joke that the people that they were trying to hook up with at the weddings were in on as well. I don't think anyone was under that many illusions about what was going on at those weddings.
Because
you know?
The movie starts off with something that, you know, many guys I know who go to weddings, and I've never thought like this certainly, talk about, which it's incredibly easy to score at a wedding. That's why you go to a wedding.
That's right. That's exactly right. That was the sort of – I think that's one of the reasons why the movie did so well. That was out in the zeitgeist, that if you go to a wedding, you're gonna go home with somebody. And, you know, these guys did, except, you know, it gets to a point where, you know, theoretically these guys could be doing this when they're 60 years old, and then it'll be embarrassing. And who knows if they would go home with somebody.
Yeah, we had that. I think that was a moment in the film that was – I liked it a lot, where they were sitting on the steps of the Capitol after that sequence of weddings. And at least Owen is aware that they're kind of too old for this. I think that bought us something with the audience, that at least one of these guys was aware that there was something sort of idiotic about this.
Were you also intent on writing an R-rated comedy as well, because that this movies have been so coy about sexuality, as you guys are saying? That presumption that audiences are afraid of or don't want this kind of thing in their lives anymore, given that – it basically passed through the 70s and 80s as being a staple, seems kind of peculiar.
One of the things was so interesting about it is when they did studies on who saw this movie, a staggering amount of older people saw this movie, people who don't normally go to movies, people older over 50. I mean, the audience was so much different than they expected. They expected it to be male under 25. It didn't work out that way. In fact, we probably did, you know, probably the least well with that demographic than the other ones. Surprising, more women saw this movie than men. A disproportionate amount of older people. And I think it's because they miss those kind of films that, you know, that they watched in the 70s and the 80s, the R-rated comedy.
And single-cell bacteria.
We did huge with
single-cell. Leave me out of this.
No,
you bring this up, Stephen. I'm curious about this, too, because I think the title makes people think that it's a much more crass movie than it actually is. And once audiences are seeing it and seeing the level of sophistication that was clearly a part of it, they were telling other people about that in those terms, don't you think?
I think you're exactly right. And I think one thing that we absolutely intended was not to make anybody feel safe. And it's sort of what we were talking about earlier with romantic comedies. There's a certain sense of safety, I think, in film now. And if you take into consideration the dinner table sequence and what happens there, that's a very unsafe scene, you know. And it was a scene we had to fight hard to write. I mean, we wrote it easily, but we had to fight to keep it in the film.
Because?
Well, there's I can't describe what takes place, but it's a very sort of vulgar moment, but intentionally vulgar and not vulgarity for vulgarity's sake. I mean, here's a very, very, very ornate dinner table, old money dinner table set with the table is surrounded by African-American help while the Secretary of Treasury is holding forth, and a very a graphic sexual act takes place underneath the table. That's really unsafe, I think, for American culture. And so I think that the safety zone is now the boring zone, and I think that's why box offices – people aren't going to the movies as much anymore. I don't think it has anything to do with cable or TV or any of that. I think people are bored.
Is that perfect for you too, Bob? You feel definitely.
And also,
people a little bit.
Yeah, for sure. Definitely. There's us, you know, that sort of anarchic spirit that Steve talked about, we want to, you know, try to always have as a part of the movies that we write. But as well, you know, you said something earlier that I appreciated about the film having some sophistication to it. That was another important thing. We wanted it to, you know, appeal to people who wanted to see a movie about wedding crashing, and then also appeal to, you know, people wanted to see a movie about a family like the Kennedys or whatever. We wanted there to be an Eleanor Roosevelt joke as well as the other things that were going on at that table, to kind of be a mix of a lot of different kinds of comedy, you know. And also the sort of tone question as to – there are a number of sort of like kind of light romantic comedy scenes in it, or sort of charming scenes right next to some fairly big comedy scenes. So it's like, what's possible in terms of tone, in terms of big set pieces next to a more heartfelt scene? How does that feel jarring? Can we make that transition? We wanted to be able to try to put that all in one movie.
We'll take a break. We're talking about The Wedding Crashers, which is now on DVD with its authors. I'm Elvis Mitchell. More after this. Shake it,
don't break it. You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment. Boys, introduce yourselves again.
Steve. I'm Steve Faber.
And I'm Bob Fisher.
We're talking about The Wedding Crashers. They are the screenwriters of the movie. As a first-produced screenplay that doesn't have a lot of what we're told movies are supposed to have in it, what was it like to sort of get that through the system?
Well, we didn't sell it right off the bat. You know, we pitched this film.
Oh, it was a pitch.
It was a pitch. We pitched it to eight studios, seven passed, and New Line bought it. So, you know, it was clearly not, you know, a home run right in the room.
The movie sat around for a while. They held on to it to release it, waiting for the optimum time to release it. Mm-hmm. That for you guys, for Bob, that kind of bolster your confidence that the studio is waiting for exactly the right moment to put it out there?
Sure. Yeah, it was very exciting to go to the – you know, this was our first movie we had produced. We had written a lot of television and written some other films, but this was the first one we had made. To go to the test, they do these – you know, for people who don't know, a tremendous amount of testing in these movies. And right off the bat from the very first testing, it was doing very well. And to watch the audience respond to this movie – it was really fun for us because to some extent we think it's funny or the actors are thinking it's funny or whatever. But when to see it with an audience, then it's one of its real test. And so it tested well. The studio wanted to put it out in summer so that it could, you know, do the full box office that was possible with it. And that was fun. Yeah.
Yeah. I enjoyed the testing. But I think, again, that's a part of the problem with mainstream Hollywood is that.
You were talking before, Steve, about having the fight to keep some scenes in.
Yeah.
I got to wonder, too, if the testing that confirm your instinct were there still some things that you had to kind of – you and the director had to fight to keep in the movie?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, first of all, we had great allies at the studio, Richard Brenner and Cale Boyder, Toby Emmerich. But, you know, we all fought to make sure this was an R-rated film. And, you know, there's just a presumption that you're going to do a lot more business with a PG-13 film, and you do. You exclude a section of your audience when you rate a film R, when you write an R-rated film. We had to fight really, really hard to make sure that that stayed. We didn't want to eviscerate the film. So in a test, though, and what I was going to say is that sometimes you have to be passionate enough about the material such that even if a film doesn't test well, you'll still make the movie because in our case we were fortunate. The film did test well, but you sometimes hit the common denominator. And that's not always good, you know, amongst a film audience. I mean, there might be films that appeal to you, Elvis, or that don't appeal to me, vice versa, but they're both great films, you know. But I think if everybody sort of agrees on the middle ground, then you're going to get middle ground films.
But you can't make a film that's going to appeal to everybody in the abstract because that ends up being film that nobody goes to.
Yeah. I mean, the irony of in testing in this particular case, though, is that, you know, so often you hear about a great film that tests poorly, but for us, some of the scenes that were testing the best were the R-rated comedy scenes that would have, you know, some studios might have been tempted to want to take out. But so, you know, at that point in time, the victory was kind of done, I think, in terms of whatever battles we had to fight.
I was going to tell you a very short anecdote. We did a pilot, a television pilot some years ago that took place. It was about a family that got, you know, just was having a breakdown as a family. They were falling apart, so they decided to go take a cross-country trip. We were going to turn it into a TV series. This was absolute death. It just didn't happen. But the reason is testing. We did the pilot, and they got stuck in a Civil War reenactment. And we tested it in front of the audience, you know, test audience. And somebody stood up and said, "Why does there need to be so much history in this?" Mm-hmm. And the pilot passed away. It just you could just see the blip on the screen just flatline as all the network executives just went, "Yes, why does there need to be so much history in it?" And you're done. Now, the irony here is the person that stood up was 16 years old. You know, I spiraled into a 2-year depression after that and thought, "Oh, good God, I'm moving to Albania and making home movies."
But the Albanian home movies are very funny. They're going to be available on DVD.
It's The Treatment. We're talking to Steve Faber and Bob Fisher, the writers of The Wedding Crashers. And were you hearing those things, Steve, that you were talking about, objections about losing demographic? You can't do this and you can't say
absolutely.
That.
Absolutely. Absolutely. R-rated comedy at strike one. You know, making these guys sort of not likable in the beginning of the film, strike two. You know, we're hearing a lot of that. Absolutely. But I think we knew deep in our guts that people wanted to see something a little different, slightly different. You know, some people didn't like the film, but I mean, I think it's different. It's not. It's also longer too, which is different.
And it's got a fully kind of formed third act,
that's
which
right.
is not just about sort of recapitulating what's happened before. The third act is, and I wonder, Bob, that was part of the thing too, is that the third act is not consonant with the other two-thirds of the movie.
Yeah, there was a very conscious effort on our part. And there are a lot of people, I think, who think it's much too long. But I personally would like to see longer movies because I feel like you get to know the characters better and you feel like you went through more of an experience. We tried to do that. But yeah, it was very conscious.
Well, I mean, even in the pitch too, when you're like working this and offering this up to executives and you tell them this third of the story that doesn't feel like the other two-thirds have come before,
mm-hmm. right.
that must have been part of or another way to sort of object to it too, because it's not the same kind of sense of one-upsmanship that has gone before that.
Absolutely.
Sure.
Owen goes to a very dark, dark place in the third act. You know, he starts crashing weddings by himself and he's not in a good place mentally. And well, this is also, you know, just the idea of somebody crashing, he crashes a funeral here. I mean, the idea of somebody crashing a funeral is, you know, it's not mainstream. So, yeah, these sorts of things did contribute to a lot of people bristling.
It seems almost like, and you guys can speak to this a lot more than I can, is that basically people are looking for a way to kind of say no, because even if they're enthusiastic about an idea, there's so much fear about it if it doesn't offer itself to what you guys are talking about, which is that sort of that vacuum form molded. These things easier to relate to. Nobody goes to these movies, but they keep making them anyway, kind of romantic comedies that don't make any sense to people.
Well, just in general, in Hollywood filmmaking, the first word is no. You know, they want to, you know, the vast majority of movies or ideas that come out don't get made. So it's just sort of a de facto kind of situation. You know, as Steve was saying earlier, we were really lucky in that the studio we were working with seemed to get exactly what we had in mind, seemed to felt the same thing. This is just one of those scenarios that doesn't happen that often, and they brought on a director, David Dobkin, who felt exactly the same way we did about the movie, and it all came out, you know, it all came out exactly as we had hoped, you know.
It'll never happen again.
Yes. Yeah, so
it will not happen this way again. It just won't. We're doing a film, and we should start up in February, called We're the Millers, which is another R-rated comedy that involves narcotics and smuggling and an idea of what family should be. And it's been very difficult to get done.
But clearly part of what – and you can even see this in The Wedding Crashers a bit – is there's a love of competition in that movie. It really is about sort of, you know what, in that kind of infantile way, if you push me, I'll push you back. We're going to see. Mm-hmm. And the competition being really kind of a theme of that movie, you guys are clearly competitive guys too, and you're not – even if the pitcher tries to brush you back off the plate, you're going to stand up to the plate again.
You have to, especially in this town. You get eaten alive. You really do. I think those characters in the film, though competitive, you know, that film was a love story, but it was really a love story between Owen and Vince, ultimately. It was about a friendship, a long, long friendship. And even in their lowest moments, they had enormous amounts of care for each other. And that was really the focus of the film.
Yeah, definitely. One of the more appealing scenes in the film was that for those people have seen it, that breakfast table scene where Owen is basically asking for Vince's help. And Vince is objecting, you know, and he has a great way of playing that kind of American character where he would tell you he's a bad guy, but ultimately will always come through with you. You know, it's like the Humphrey Bogart made a career playing that as all Mark Twain stuff is this guy. It's very appealing because you know, the audience knows, before even Vince knows, that he's going to help out his friend. And the kind of language of friendship is another theme that sort of interests us. Steve and I actually wrote together in the high school newspaper. We go back 27 years, you know. So it's like,
Or maybe not. It's
maybe
the
not.
Treatment. I'm talking to Steve Faber and Bob Fisher, the authors of The Wedding Crashers. A lot of this too relates to your own personal experience, I mean, in terms of things you've done. I mean, crashing weddings and that kind of thing, basically.
Yeah, we crashed a lot of political events. I worked in Washington and picked up some techniques, and then Bob and I crashed stuff in L.A. I worked in Washington and had no money, so I crashed. I made fake laminated badges and crashed lobbyist events. The Shrimpers, for example, were a great lobbying group because you had many different kinds of shrimp. So, and you could eat, and because I was living with four other guys, we all had no money in a little apartment. We had no silverware or plates or anything. So you'd go in and you'd eat, open your briefcase, tell everybody you were the legislative aide to Senator, at that time, Cranston, and dump a lot of silverware and plates and then stuff your pockets with shrimp. Now, when we got back to L.A., Bob and I crashed the Democratic National Committee, Republican National Committee platform meetings in L.A., did the same thing. Our guys in the film crashed for sex. We crashed for food, which I think gives you a good sense of where our lives are at.
But they're kind of all about appetites, aren't they?
Yeah, definitely. That was a fun thing writing for Vince's character. Just it wasn't just the sexual appetite that, you know, that is, he had a love of crab cakes that, you know, that was almost had a sexual nature to it.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. But it's funny because it really is. And these films we're talking about, these 30 screwball comedies, yeah. the comedies of the 70s, there is that, even though there's that friendship that's the bedrock of all those things. And love stories between those couples, you know, who are competing. But there's still that sense of – very American sense of competition. You know, they – okay, I love you, but you don't get to one-up me.
Yeah.
You know?
Sure.
And then together, they don't get to one-up us.
Well, there's no – and there's no game in that for those guys. That sense of, sort of sub-Darwin depravity that they engage in, because at the end, you know, they have to work together and, you know, to get the girls. And I have no – feeling or no real strong sense that they're going to stay with those girls at the end.
That's the thing about it too. I mean, it's got that sense that we don't often get from romantic comedies, that sort of what next sense. What's going to happen to these people after this is all over?
Yeah, that we wanted to, as much as possible, leave some degree of ambiguity at the ending. I mean, it's not as ambiguous as that great moment in the Graduate when they're sitting on the back of the bus. But we clearly had something like that in mind when they were riding off in that car, that at least to echo that we don't know. Certainly the hard work will be in front of them. They're with these people now, but we'll see what happens.
Well, the question, though, because that an ending like that begs the question of sequel.
Well, originally we had them, smiling and laughing and then drive off a cliff. But because we didn't want to do the sequel. But the – no, I'm kidding. I'm sure there might be a sequel. I'm not sure there will be a sequel.
Would you guys want to get involved with it?
Perhaps. Maybe. We'll see.
Yeah, you will see. You know, you create characters and you want to you don't necessarily want other people writing them, I think is really what it comes down to. There's something
– Bob's talking about cash.
Here, yeah.
That's what it boils down to. It's pretty much – we can sit and yammer on about values and, oh, yeah, this or that or 30 screwball romantic comedies. But it boils down to cash, how big the check is. At this point, because we're not spring chickens anymore, Elvis.
So Balzac said it best, greed, the great equalizer.
But, sure.
But you must feel like to some extent that you wanted to end it like this because you wanted to have them go forward with this, because if they do, then it becomes kind of empty. I mean, how do you solve those problems of these people still being at the end kind of infantile?
I don't think we tried. We never intended to solve the problem. What we tried to do was illuminate one aspect of human nature.
But I'm saying that if you go ahead and do a sequel.
You're right.
Yeah,
this is why I don't care for sequels, with one exception, The Godfather. I think those were great sequels. But I think in a romantic comedy, I think sequels can be very, very difficult.
Maybe The Karate Kid, maybe.
Karate Kid, too.
Yeah. Well, when you think romantic comedy, you think Karate Kid anyway, don't you?
You do.
My guests have been Steve Faber and Bob Fisher, the writers of The Wedding Crashers. It's my pleasure to have you here. It's a great movie, and I'm thrilled you guys to do the show.
Thank you so much.
I really appreciate it. Yeah.
Our technical director is Mario Diaz. Bob Carlson is the editor. Mary Holdridge, the producer. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
An audio archive of this and other programs can be found at kcrw.com. For questions and comments about The Treatment, please email us at thetreatment@kcrw.com. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.
You've been listening to KCRW's The Treatment. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including The Business, a look deep inside the business of entertainment with Hollywood's top dealmakers, filmmakers, moguls, artists, and agents. Hosted by Claude Brodesser. Check out the podcast of The Business at kcrw.com.